celebrate the music's power as a democratic and liberatory medium. At 6 p.m., we take you to Tangier, Morocco, host city for the 2024 International Jazz Day Concert, led by Herbie Hancock, with performances by Lakeisha Benjamin, Didi Bridgewater, master Ghanaian musician Abdella El Gord, and Shamika Copeland, among others. That's Jazz, Resistance, and Liberation, the global impact of a national treasure, to commemorate International Jazz Day this Tuesday, April 30th, noon until 8 p.m. WPFW, building a jazzier world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
From WPFW News in Washington, this is Monday Morning QB, a news program with a point of view. Today is Monday, April 29th, 2024. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Today on the show, an update from the protest encampment at the George Washington University campus. Plus, why the Supreme Court needs to rule sooner rather than later on Donald Trump's claims of presidential immunity. All that and more, stay with us. A protest encampment on the George Washington University campus entered its fifth day today, with over 100 tents spread across the campus's U Yard and neighboring H Street. A barricade around the encampment was taken down by protesters last night, and police clashed with demonstrators as they tried and failed to arrest one student. Joining us this morning to discuss the protest is Dr. Irene Kalis, a Palestinian faculty member in American University's Department of Critical Race, Gender, and Culture Studies. She is Director of Arab World Studies and Faculty Advisor to AU's Students for Justice in Palestine. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Kalis.
Thank you for having me.
To start, could you provide a general update on the status of the protest encampment this morning, and then talk about your role in supporting students as a faculty member?
Yeah, thank you. I'd be happy to. Well, the encampment is still holding strong. These students are steadfast in their commitments, and they are determined, and it is there have been multiple attempts to shut them down and dismiss and to delegitimize their concerns and aims, but they are still there, and it is growing.
And specifically, it seems like there was an attempt to arrest a student last night. Do you have any updates on what police activity has been like around the encampment in the last day?
Yes, well, it intensified last night, late last night, police presence came into the encampment, and the student successfully protected the encampment and the student who was being arrested, or they attempted to arrest, the police attempted to arrest. And at the moment, it seems to have calmed down, and the tents are up and there.
And to clarify, do you know if this was MPD or some campus police that was attempting to arrest?
MPD.
Sure. Can you talk about your role as a faculty advisor to the, you know, the AU Students for Justice in Palestine, but also sort of a, you know, a faculty supporter, broadly speaking, of this encampment? What's your role in supporting students and making sure that they're protected?
Yes, I think this is one of the central things that I've been thinking about, and many of my colleagues right now across the DMV. What we are seeing is that, you know, faculty and staff are on the front lines right now and trying to protect their students. And they're doing so, and also, as we have seen, being targeted violently by the police and by the administrations, because we have to make it clear that any calls to bring in police would have to come from the very top of universities. So we're talking about presidents and the high-level cabinet members who are bringing the police. So faculty are being targeted for protecting the university's own students. But, you know, it is not surprising that faculty are on the front lines with their students, because the students are our compass in what we do. And this moment is really underscoring the importance of that bond between faculty and staff and students in trying to help protect them and advocate for them. And what this is also, this moment is also making very clear, is that for these universities and their administrations who are meeting our students, their own students right now, with a repressive violence. They are showing us that their own students are not their compass. And this is why the bond between the committed faculty and staff is operating so centrally right now. And I say committed faculty and staff because not everybody is stepping up, even as we need them to. So we have a formidable group of faculty and staff across the DMV who together, through our own networking and organizing, are trying in every way possible to protect these students and help and support them in any way we can. In the face of what our own university leadership is doing to them. So they are our prime priority. I also want to pay special attention here to the courageous staff across these universities. It's not just faculty, you know, and it's often the staff who are the ones being made to enforce these repressive anti-student policies. And many of the staff are refusing to do so, and they're refusing to do so at great risk. And you know, many are vulnerable and insecure, and many do it anonymously, but they are refusing. And I think this is really important to highlight as well. As a faculty member, I am incredibly upset at the moment, and very, it's very emotional to watch the kind of assault that our students are facing. You know, these are our students. We see them in the classroom, the kind of thought, care, analysis that they are bringing to this moment and to their classrooms in the same moment that, as my partner Nejim has said, you know, the administration is really assaulting their beauty. And as faculty, we are witnessing and we are seeing how they are being criminalized, how their clarity is being criminalized. And, you know, the other day in my class, I was overcome, and my tears came out, and I couldn't hold them back in watching and listening to our students articulate, you know, their analysis and their kind of understanding of our course material across this semester, and thinking about how their own administration, who I have witnessed, are just criminalizing that clarity. So it's very painful.
You mentioned faculty being targeted. I wonder if you can describe more what that looks like and kind of compare and contrast it to the ways that students themselves are being targeted and maybe how the similarities between the way that those two groups are being targeted, you know, builds bonds between the two groups.
Yes, that is a wonderful question. I think, you know, it occurs in different ways. The students are the most vulnerable and they are our priority. And so my bringing up the faculty is only as a way to illustrate how it comes down to faculty and staff in protecting these students in this moment, instead of the university administrations, which is what one would think that they would be holding at their center. So faculty are targeted in different ways because we are all vulnerable in different ways. Some, you know, many of us actually doing this work are contingent faculty. So we already have an insecure, you know, a job insecurity, a vulnerability. There's different kinds of statuses, which I don't want to go into, which make faculty vulnerable. And so there's always that threat of even, you know, as we've seen, the highest kind of profile faculty who are being targeted in these ways. And then we also see right now illustrated in very physical material terms how the police are brutalizing faculty who are trying to protect these students. And so, yes, I think that bond you mentioned is really important because it is a bond of commitment. You know, it's a bond of commitment and courage that the students are modeling for us. And sadly, you know, we need to see more of our faculty stepping up and protecting them, because the fact of them speaking and their courage comes from the topic of Palestine itself, which is what engenders more silence across faculty spaces in the universities, because the issue of Palestine, as we know, is the taboo. And it is precisely because it's the taboo that students in these encampments are being targeted in these particular kinds of ways.
Sure. You mentioned faculty and staff, and I'm curious, of course, there's a broader campus community, and the GW campus is sort of easily bleeds into the rest of downtown. I'm curious how community broadly has supported or reacted to the protest. Of course, we've seen examples of political support, you know, folks joining protests alongside the encampment, as well as material support in terms of donations of food. How have folks, community folks, supported the encampment, and how do students need support going forward?
The community has been absolutely incredible and central. In fact, you know, from the day one on Thursday when the encampment started, the 25th, it was through a kind of collective community organizing and spirit that staved off different forms of moments of intense fear that the police were going to be brought in. And we have called out the community in particular to come and help protect the students because the numbers matter. And that was demonstrated very clearly on Thursday. So that first day was a very intense kind of it was an intense kind of dynamic because a lot of policies were being made up as they went along, and we were hearing a lot of different things coming from administration, a lot of fear mongering, it turned out to be. I'm not sure what we don't know exactly how it played out between the administration and the police, but there were several moments when we were told by administration that the police were coming to sweep. And sweep, we know what that looks like. We see what that looks like. So there's an inherent terror that comes to that. And it was in those moments that faculty in particular and staff formed a ring around the encampment. And there was a lot of press there too, which probably played into that. And then we also made calls to the community to come and help hold the students. And they came in scores. And that in itself also seemed to have neutralized the second intended sweep that was supposed to happen in the evening, or we were told was supposed to happen. And the community has been there every single day. And saying that, we also need more. We need more protection. We need more students and faculty across these spaces to come to this encampment, because the encampment is a coalition of students across the DMV area that collectively are holding this encampment in GW. So it is at GW, but it is a collection, a collective of students across these spaces.
Yeah, I wanted to dig more into this. I come from a student organizing background myself as an alum of the University of Maryland. I did a lot of student labor organizing. And I remember in those student organizing days how valuable I found interactions with organizers, other student organizers on other campuses, even, you know, Oregon, really far away, because we were able to share tactics and ideas and realize how similar our struggles were, despite the differences, the idiosyncratics of different campuses. You know, without divulging critical information, can you talk about how important cross-campus communication has been for this GW encampment and the sort of broader student encampment movement that we've seen crop up recently?
Yes, it has been central. And, you know, there has been a coalition that we have been forming over the past number of years. So this doesn't just occur in a vacuum. You know, this coalition between student groups across, in recognizing how important their collaboration and their collective voice is, has been central to the organizing. And students are also communicating with other universities, you know, and other university initiatives and students. So student-to-student communication and power is central here and has been one of the key aspects of its success. And really, not just its success, the beauty of that collectivity that is very palpable and visible to anybody that goes into these spaces. And I want to just also say that the administration knows this precisely, because this is the exact reason. You know, Thursday I was talking about that initial day when things were unfolding and very unclear, and where the community came out in scores in the evening to help hold and protect the students. The very next morning is when the barricade was put up. So we know that they strategically isolated, you know, attempted to isolate the students in the encampment from this collectivity. But they didn't realize how they're undermining the power of this collectivity, because the very next day is when the encampment broke out onto the street and the numbers have continued. So the sharing of information, of tactics, of strategies is inherent to organizing. And these students have been amazing in that. And what's really, you know, striking to see and beautiful to see is that there's a real consensus collectivist ethos to what they are doing. You know, when there isn't a hierarchical structure, these students are deciding together, they're dividing the label together. You know, there are folks doing the cleaning, folks doing the speaking. You know, there's a very collectivist ethos that's operating in practice, and it's really beautiful to watch.
Turning to goals here, it seems like there's kind of two buckets of demands. One is about demanding that universities cut ties, both academic and financial, to Israel and reveal or disclose their endowments and investments so that any commitment to cutting ties to Israel can actually be enforced. And then separately, there is a growing demand for, across this encampment protest movement, a growing demand for amnesty for students and faculty who have been disciplined by universities or by police if they've been arrested. Can you speak to these two goals and why they're important as a paired set of goals? Why linking the political goals, I guess, of de-linking from Israel with the need to protect students is so important?
Yes, thank you. I think the issue of amnesty is center, and it's really more than the idea of amnesty needs to be located in the institutional cultures of these universities. And it is, you know, I can speak for American University, but certainly for GW, we've seen, and others in the DMV to various degrees, there is a deeply embedded anti-Palestinianism that is part of the normalized culture of these institutions. So all of these student organizers, and I would say, you know, and what I've seen in our own space is that the majority are not Palestinian, they're not Arab, and they're not Muslim, right? So we have a striking, you know, diverse composition of student identities who are speaking and moving in these spaces, but they are all subject to this very strong and powerful material anti-Palestinianism. So you cannot even speak about Palestine. You know, there are literally less than a handful of courses across the DMV that actually teach about Palestine. There is an absence of knowledge production about Palestine. Faculty are targeted. We are surveyed. Students are surveyed in docs for speaking about Palestine. There are very influential donors and other third-party organizations that are operating, like the Anti-Defamation League, you know, at American University, that are operating in these spaces. So, you know, the power structures are working against them already. So it is not just an amnesty. They are highlighting this anti-Palestinianism that is embedded in these institutions. And because of that anti-Palestinianism, they are demanding that these issues be heard, and that, speaking against the oppression of academic expression, critical thinking, that are all operating. So I have witnessed myself as part of someone who's involved with these dynamics, who teaches on Palestine as well, that a lot, you know, the repressive policies we are seeing, especially at American University, are specifically oriented around Palestine and speaking Palestine. So that is the fundamental requirement that students are speaking to. And the divestment issue is directly connected, because historically, the wider divestment movement has not been allowed to address Palestine itself. And so now we're seeing student organize, you know, student governments, which are not radical spaces, adopting these BDS resolutions. And in the same instance, of course, immediately the administration shutting that down. So to go back to your question, the anti-Palestinianism that's embedded in these institutions is the base of the demands. And I think it also requires us to understand what these encampments have emerged from. They didn't just come out of nowhere. For many months, and I have directly witnessed this and been with the students as well as my colleagues, the student especially intensified on October 7th, but of course not starting there, is that our university leaders and our presidents have been consistently messaging that there is only one particular community that the university administration is concerned about. And that dovetails with specific donors and specific board members in our case. And so students have been actively alienated, delegitimized, silenced, made invisible, Palestinian, Muslim, Arab students and anti-Zionist Jews, which are hundreds working and speaking in these spaces. We have sat through many meetings with various different administrative leaders trying to be heard, you know, for these students to be heard, that their active concerns. Not once, you know, has our administration honored even or even spoken about the trauma that they're experiencing from the genocidal annihilation of Palestinian life that's occurring, that they're directly connected to and their families are. And what came from each of these meetings and attempts to be heard was more repressive policies and alienation that specifically targeted Palestinian-centered initiatives, voices, et cetera. So that is the context through which this encampment emerges. It is an exasperation. You know, it is after many months of being shut down, delegitimized, and silenced by their own administration.
That's unfortunately all the time we have this morning, but I want to thank you, Dr. Irene Kalis, for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I just want to underscore that what's going on in these spaces is an ethos of learning, community, and care amongst these students, that it really goes against the kind of delegitimization that they are that is being portrayed and spoken about them.
Absolutely. We've been hearing from Dr. Irene Kalis, a Palestinian faculty member in American University's Department of Critical Race, Gender, and Culture Studies. She is director of Arab World Studies and faculty advisor to AU's Students for Justice in Palestine.
The Supreme Court heard arguments last week regarding former President Donald Trump's claim that the federal charges accusing him of plotting to overturn his 2020 election loss to Joe Biden must be thrown out because he is immune from being prosecuted for any so-called official act he took as president. A majority of the justices did not appear to embrace his claim of absolute immunity that would necessarily stop Special Counsel Jack Smith's prosecution of Donald Trump. At the same time, several members of the Republican-appointed majority seem to indicate that some limited form of protection, like the qualified immunity that can apply to other government officials, was needed for Donald Trump and future U.S. presidents. Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Samuel Alito, and Justice Clarence Thomas all raised concerns that without protections, presidents could face politically motivated prosecution for actions they take while in office. Kathy Feng is Vice President of Programs for Common Cause, and she joined us to explain the legal framework for what the Supreme Court is sorting through in this case.
The Supreme Court has a very large question that it is trying to decide. The question isn't just whether there should be immunity granted to a U.S. president, but where to draw the line. And I think that there's a real concern on both sides. On the one side, there is concern that if you don't have some level of immunity, that it could have a chilling effect. But on the other side, the very real concern that we share with Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson is you don't want to remove all checks on criminal behavior. because you have the most powerful person in the world who could turn the Oval Office into, as she said, the seat of a criminal enterprise. And we do not want to create an incentive for any candidate to step into office thinking that they can act with entire abandon for our criminal justice system. And so that question about where to draw the line is what the Supreme Court is now struggling with.
And as they do, of course, an election is taking place, which is what led Common Cause to file an amicus brief with the Supreme Court before arguments were heard in Donald Trump v. United States, urging the court to issue a ruling quickly. So if they decide that the former president is not immune in the January 6 case from prosecution over election interference, the district court has sufficient time to hold a trial before the November election. And voters will have a fuller and rightfully deserved sense of his conduct and character.
We don't have a situation very often where somebody who is the candidate is also the former president who is being investigated and now charged with criminal acts of corruption and other violations of the law. And because the candidate currently is being considered by voters, whether to vote for them or some other candidate, it is absolutely important that we have resolution to that case so that voters can make a decision that will affect the next 4 years of America's democracy. In other cases that have involved this kind of important question, and probably the most apt analogy is in the Nixon case in 1974, the court acted very quickly, took a total of 1 month from the minute that they got the request from prosecution and Nixon, all the way to the decision that they ultimately issued about the question of whether prosecution could have access to tape recordings of Nixon's conversation. They took 1 month.
And those tapes enabled the House to vote on Nixon's impeachment, leading to his resignation 2 weeks later. However, even with Nixon as an example of how quickly the Supreme Court can move when it chooses to on charges of alleged misconduct by a president, when it comes to making this decision about Donald Trump's immunity to the charges he currently faces of conspiracy and obstruction, there is already an indication that this case may move at a slower pace. That's because during last week's hearing, the justices focused a great deal of their questioning on definition. In other words, if some level of presidential immunity were to be granted, the question then becomes where to draw the line in order to determine how an official act could be distinguished from a private action that could be subject to prosecution. And even within the context of an official act, at what point is the president to be held accountable for criminal behavior?
If we think that our U.S. president should be able to act in certain official capacity without fear of criminal prosecution, then when would we allow for a criminal prosecution to happen? Where is the line that we would draw? If you frame it that way, then you're going to spend a lot of time talking about what's an official act, what's not an official act, how much criminal activity, evidence of criminal activity do you have to have before you can start to investigate something, even if it falls within the official act. You could say that the official act line makes no sense, right? And it's simply what types of activity constitute prosecutable crimes when it comes to the presidency. And I think that a lot of those questions are probably the types of things that they're struggling with right now. So if the president, for instance, orders military troops to find and kill someone who has been charged with committing acts of terrorism on U.S. soil or ordering acts of terrorism on U.S. soil, how do you distinguish that from ordering the military to find and kill a political opponent? And I'm guessing that that's part of the active conversation that might be happening behind closed doors.
Given what seemed to be a priority by the Supreme Court to ask these kinds of questions before granting immunity, it's entirely possible that the justices say in their ruling that the lower court has to go through each charge against Trump in the four-count indictment and decide if it crosses the bar into prosecution before a trial can take place. This, of course, could add considerable delay to the process and make it increasingly unlikely that Trump's trial on charges of election interference will not happen before the election. Because even if the court did not bump the decision to the lower court and decided the trial actually can go ahead, there's not much more time left for that decision to allow for a trial before November.
If the decision does not come down until June, it does make it very difficult for a trial to take place, partly because the lower court needs to give both parties time to prepare. And once you get into the time frame of September, October, it becomes so close to the elections that prosecution may choose not to pursue the case at that time and delay until after the elections, because there is a standing practice that they don't want to influence the elections that way. So as a matter of course, if the decision comes out sometime in April, even early May, it is still a possibility that the trial could move forward and we could have resolution before the election.
Of course, as we just heard, there is a strong possibility that is not what happens. And given the potential that could have on the democratic process, the amicus briefing filed by Common Cause also carries a warning, which is that a failure to act quickly could open the court to the perception that it is attempting to influence the 2024 election in favor of Trump, which Kathy Fang says could undermine the public's faith in the Supreme Court, and that is nothing to be taken lightly.
I think that it's absolutely important that people have trust that one of the pillars of our three branches of government that we all learned from Schoolhouse Rock has the ability to take politics out of the decision and make a speedy decision for the sake of allowing this case to move forward. There is concern that if the Supreme Court simply bows to partisan pressure or has a partisan bias, that they might allow for Trump's delay tactics to essentially succeed by slow walking this case. And that shadow is one that nobody wants to be cast on the Supreme Court.
Especially this Supreme Court, which is already dealing with questions of impartiality when making decisions that could have political impact.
Unfortunately, there has been a swirl of corruption and personal interest and partisan interest around several of the justices. Earlier this year and last year, we had revelations that Justice Thomas had received a lot of favors and support from major donors who also pushed a certain partisan agenda. And his wife was very closely involved with activities that suggested that she was communicating directly with members of the Trump administration about January 6th and the actions around trying to subvert the vote. So there is a real question about whether some of the Supreme Court justices have a conflict of interest. At the same time, there are justices, both conservative and liberal, who very much guard zealously the reputation of the Supreme Court as an entity that can make decisions on behalf of all American people and for justice overall. And that includes, I would say, Chief Justice Roberts. So I think that there is a fair argument that people have about concerns about the interests of certain justices, But also, there is an opportunity for the Supreme Court as a whole to act with impartiality on this case in particular, to show that it can decide quickly and decisively around an issue that I think there is not a whole lot of disagreement around. President does not have absolute immunity. There clearly is a line that can be drawn. There was even agreement between defense counsel and a lot of the questioning coming from justices about where some of those lines could be drawn. They should be able to decide this quickly and allow for the criminal proceedings to make their way to court and trial in time for voters to be able to understand what the outcome is when they're going to the polls in November.
And it's not just the question of absolute immunity that the justices could quickly decide on. They could decide that in this particular case, there is no need for any court to go through the process of questioning whether this case meets any kind of new standards for qualified immunity, because clearly it does not.
They could also just say, you know what, we can't decide all those things, but we can say this universe of things that are before us right now do constitute things that could be prosecutable as a crime, and therefore we're going to order the lower court to move forward, right? That it could be as clear-cut as that and very limited. Right. We're not going to decide what's an official act. We're not going to decide what might be prosecutable in a larger sense. What we will decide is that this set of questions that was presented to the lower court do fall within acts that could be prosecutable because they are neither official or they are clearly illegal if the facts as alleged are true.
In closing, Kathy Fang says that even while this case is eating up an extraordinary amount of attention that could be devoted to any number of other pressing concerns in terms of elections and democracy, there is something to be gained along the way.
You just never expected that we were going to have a president who would actually say that they should be absolutely immune from prosecution. Every single small d democratic norm has been thrown into question. But the silver lining is that the American people are having a hard conversation and we are deciding together the norms that we need to uphold in order to ensure that our democracy works for all of us.
Kathy Fang is Vice President of Programs for Common Cause. You can read their amicus brief on Trump's immunity claim at commoncause.org. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Reporter Asia Beckham is up next.
Freddy Mntangwa was 18 years old when the genocide in Rwanda began. Only he and his sister survived from his family. Since the incident, he has helped gather the testimonies and photographs from thousands of survivors of the 1994 genocide against the Tutsis, which left an estimated 800,000 Rwandans dead. Here's his story.
My name is Freddy Mntangwa. I'm the CEO of Aegis Trusts and the director of Kigali Genocide Memorial. We have 250,000 victims of genocide buried in the same site, alongside the mass graves. Actually, we built a museum to explain 1994 genocide, the preparation, the execution, the aftermath, and also the consequences of genocide, but also how do we prevent to happen again in Rwanda and outside the Rwanda. I'm a survivor of genocide Tutsi, and I lost my parents and my four sisters. And before genocide, the country that's been treating the Tutsis as an enemy, and my parents actually tried to overcome it and tried to not showing the situation I've been living in, but they tried to raise me with as a happy child. I lost them in 1994 when they killed alongside with over a million Tutsi in this country that killed and slaughtered in 1994 in Rwanda. Tutsi and the Hutus, they share the same language, the same culture, the same religion. So they've been people living side by side, as centuries. The only difference that was established by colonial powers to India politics of divide and rule. So when I was a student, I came to understand who is Tutsi, who is Hutu. And this was done through these teachers teaching about discrimination between Hutu and Tutsis. Each and every morning, the Tutsi were asked to stand up. I remember when I was in the second grade, my teacher, who's still alive, actually, she asked the Tutsi to stand up. The comment that she made, saying that those who stood up, the Tutsi, they're cockroaches, they're snakes, and the enemies of Rwanda. So this actually to show the Hutu children that we are not the same people, but we are labeled as enemies, we are labeled as cockroaches and all sort of dehumanization. That actually was how the young people been introduced to understand and to know who is the Tutsi and the Hutu. My friend Jean-Pierre, who is my rescuer, he was my colleague at the primary school, and we were neighbors. He belonged to Hutu group, and I was belonging to Tutsi group, but that difference really didn't mean anything between us. So when they started to attack our house, that was on 7th of April, my mom advised me to go to my friend house, and my friend can hide me. Him and his dad been really very helpful, and they saved my life. So unfortunately, after genocide, because he died after genocide and 2 months after genocide, and I didn't see him again. There's government and the army, they took all civilians, Hutu people, to be refugees in the Congo. So he went to Congo, and while he was in a refugee camp, I heard that he died with diarrhea. He died because he was sick. He died in a refugee camp. April 14th of April was the time I lost my parents. And is the date I lost my 4 sisters. And I was not at home, but I was not very far. I was at Peter's house, and I was hiding under bed. And like 60 militias attacked my house. And when they attacked, everyone actually started to save his or her life. Everyone ran away. My parents, because they took them away. The 4 sisters were very young. They couldn't really run. They couldn't know how to hide themselves. So they were captured, and they started with my parents, and they killed them with machetes in the clubs, and they didn't bury them. So we had to, and they were buried in very shallow grave. My sisters have been killed on the 15th of April, and they thrown them alive, and they killed them with the stones they've been throwing on top of them. And the younger one who been crying because she was saying that I will never be a Tutsi again anymore, and she been really crying and screaming, actually requesting for really to be heard and to be saved, but no one had any heart to save them. They killed them all with the stones that been throwing on top of their head until they finished them. This life without this affection of your parents, losing your siblings, but also the extended family, it's really hurting. But I've been I've been lucky to live with my parents, who've been really transmitted their resilience in me, but also their the last conversation with my mom, who pleaded me to be a man when I get I survive. To be a man, that word is very it's very meaningful. I'm trying to uzawa mugabo. If you survive, be a man. It's really very significant, and it means a lot. It means that if you survive, fill the gap, live where we are not, and be strong. I managed to give proper barrier to my mother, because when they were killed, they were given a shallow grave. So in October 1994, I exhumed their bodies, but they were properly buried in 2001, which the time I felt really I did my home, my responsibility as a survivor, and the time I felt that I was able to give decent burial to my family in 2001, and this was something really I felt that it's really my responsibility to do that. The second thing is my journey to forgiveness, which has been a journey, because right after genocide, I lived with anger. I lived with feeling of revenge and feeling that, and even ask you so many questions, and why did they kill them? And why did this happen to me? And why I was in a denial of what happened to me and the life I was living in. So it was a big struggle for me, and until I joined an association of student survivors called ARG. I became one of the leaders, and this association of the student have been talking, I was able to find a group that really I can identify myself in, and that group really have many people, and the members have been ready to listen to me, and we've been listening to each other. We've been crying together as a student. We've been sharing all the challenges and issues that's really been actually making our life difficult. And this really been the starting point of my healing process. And the second point I want to mention here, when I finished my studies and I was employed by Kigali Genocide Memorial as a data collector, I've been collecting really documents and the testimonies from survivors and from rescuers and even from the perpetrators who asked for forgiveness and repented. And I've been going to them and I ask if they can give us testimonies. And from that period, we were able to establish a documentation center, which been since then have been used by our researchers and with the archive that was created from the document we collected in 2004. I went to my village and I met people who been participating in killing my family. I met the guy, his name is John, who been involved killing my sisters. One of the village member asked me, a mixed group can come to visit the memorial. I organized a bus. 19 people went into bus. I took them around. One of the perpetrator, when he was touring into the museum, and he got stuck on a picture of one of the of a child being killed by machete. And by when he was reading this child's story, and I saw him crying, and I was really confused. And I was like, maybe because this person had been killing so many people, and how can, I thought that when he gets where they talk about how people been killed, he will be feeling, oh, I did the same. I know what he's talking about. But instead, actually, he was very sad. He was very full of emotion. And I was thinking that that time, that how I realized even the killers and the perpetrators have a spark of humanity that we can nurture. So that's how we created the continuum of violence, the 10 steps to genocide or to mass atrocities or to violence. And then also this perpetrator actually gave us an idea that there's a possibility from genocide to peace. Actually, we created a 10-step, a continuum benevolence, which is 10 steps from genocide, from violence to peace. So those actually have been tools that have been used in education program. And for me, by testing myself, by accepting that I can have perpetrators and take them around, have been one of the starting points for my forgiveness journey. Until recently, last year, I've been able to go to prison and visited Samson, who had been the leader of militias who attacked our house and killed my family. And I visited him in prison. He was among the militias who killed my sisters, thrown them in septic tank and killed them with stones that had been throwing on top of their head. He was put in prison for 21 or 22 years. And since genocide stopped, but now he's out because he finished his sentence and he's now free, back to his community, his family. The only reason I wanted to have an interaction with my perpetrator if he asked for forgiveness, I was very, very ready to forgive him. Unfortunately, he was not ready. And he was trying to not telling me the truth. But in my heart, I've forgiven him. And I have another appointment with him this coming week to go and see him. I'll be happy if he can feel remorse. I can feel much more telling the truth, but also willing to receive for forgiveness. And I'll be happy to forgive him because the only gift I can give to the world and to my family and to myself is to forgive my perpetrator so that we can be a model for breaking the cycle of violence, but at the same time showing that forgiveness is possible. I've been working for Kigali Genocide Memorial. I met many survivors, including Holocaust survivors. And I remember when I met my friend Margit. Unfortunately, she's no longer with us. And I met a Holocaust survivor who is still alive, and he lives in Philadelphia. His name is Emil Fish, and I can see, and it was really very very important moment having survivors meeting. The survivors really from different story and different context, the Holocaust and the genocide against Tutsi. And it was really very, very good moment to share our own stories, our own experience and own life. And some of them actually have grandchildren. I've been really very much learning from how to transmit the memory and the resilience to your children. I learned a lot from Holocaust survivors at the Kigali Genocide Memorial.
That was Freddie Mentangwa, who was 18 when the genocide against the Tutsis in Rwanda began.
That's reporter Asia Beckham. To close the show today, we turn to some music. Lebanese singer and songwriter Ahmad Kabour wrote the iconic song Una Dikum in 1975 at the outbreak of the Lebanese Civil War. That song, based on a poem by Palestinian poet Tawfiq Ziad, begins with lyrics in Arabic translated as, quote, I call out to you, I clasp onto your hands, and I kiss the earth beneath your soles, and I say, I'm prepared to die for your sake. Here's Una Dikum by Ahmad Kabour.
وصنت العشب الأخضر فوق قبور أسلافي
حملت دمي على كفي وما ركزت على مين
وصمت العشب الأخضر فوق قبور أسلافي
أناديكم أشد على أياديكم